Everywhere you look, the jobs market seems in upheaval. John Deere employees are going on strike, as are some nurses, even the folks who make Oreos. And more people are quitting their jobs than ever before, on a bet that they can do better somewhere else and make more money. Our next guest is an authority on wages and jobs and the economy. David Card this week shared the Nobel Prize in Economics with two peers in the field. He teaches economics at the University of California, Berkeley, where he joins us from via Skype. David Card, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
So let's step back a little bit and talk about your defining work on the minimum wage in the 90s. For years, it was economic gospel that if you raise the minimum wage, it's a problem. Businesses are saddled with higher costs, so they can't hire as many people. But you found otherwise?
Yeah, I worked on a project with Alan Krueger, who at the time we were both professors at Princeton University, and we found out that New Jersey was proposing to raise their minimum wage, and we were sitting in the library at Princeton and thought about it and decided to try and do a survey and figure out what would happen if you raised the minimum wage. So we interviewed fast food restaurants on the New Jersey side of the Delaware River, on our side, and then just across the river in Pennsylvania, as many as we could. Both states had, at the time we did the first interview, had the same minimum wage for $25 an hour. And then New Jersey's then went up to $5.05 an hour, which was, you know, a fairly significant increase, almost 20%. And then we re-interviewed the same stores, and we tried to do an analysis and see, was there any evidence that the stores in New Jersey had shed workers relative to those in Pennsylvania?
How do you explain what you found? It seems that in the real world study that you did, a higher minimum wage didn't necessarily mean fewer jobs.
At the time, it was very similar labor market to what we have today. Very pretty good market. There were lots of restaurants looking for workers to come in. There was many of the fast food restaurants had a bonus program. So if you were a worker there and you brought in a friend to work, you could get like $75 or $100. People who came would get a kind of a signing bonus. So it was very similar to the same things we have today. And you might ask yourself in that scenario, okay, there's a tight labor market. Why don't the employers just raise wages? Why do they have these crazy bonuses and incentives for other people? And the answer is the employer has some discretion to set a wage, and they've got a bunch of people working for them now at the lower wage. If they raise the wage, they have to give them a raise, and they would get more workers, but it would cost them some money. So if that's the scenario, which it was at that time, and you then say, okay, well, sorry, but you got to raise the wage, they will raise the wage for the existing workers, and they'll also get those new people to come in that they were looking for.
Now this work that you did alongside Alan Krueger connected to real policy changes. Let's take a listen to President Clinton's State of the Union speech in 1995.
Now, I've studied the arguments and the evidence for and against a minimum wage increase. I believe the weight of the evidence is that a modest increase does not cost jobs and may even lure people back into the job market.
I do want to ask you about this intersection between academic work and the real world. I mean, your work is out there in the world that's been recognized by the Nobel Committee. And then, of course, in the real world in politics, the stated assumptions are otherwise. We have Larry Kudlow in the Trump administration. He said raising the minimum wage was a terrible idea. So is it frustrating when you hear some of these debates and you wonder, you know, where's your data?
Well, you know, my study was done almost 30 years ago. There's been a very large number of subsequent studies, many using, you know, much larger data sets, looking at multiple changes in minimum wages across state borders. None of those studies find these big employment losses that those guys are predicting. But what I was just talking about, the employer that's got a bunch of workers in-house that he's paying a lower wage to and then forced to raise the minimum wage, it's going to cost that employer money. So they're going to fight it. And they're going to get lobbyists to lobby against it, and they're going to enlist people to, you know, conduct fake studies to find whatever they want. Same with climate change, same with, you know, reactions to COVID vaccines. You can't really expect people to necessarily follow academic research.
I live in Washington, where you can buy your study if you want to.
And there's lots of people available.
Yes, that I understand too. Your field uses what are known as natural experiments. When something happens in the world, change in the law, a war, a pandemic. Suddenly there's this opportunity, right, to study people on either side of a line, those who get drafted and those who don't. When you look at this pandemic, are there economic questions that interest you?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's lots of things going on, very interesting. But the pandemic is actually a really good illustration of a problem with an actual experiment methodology. And this, in the case of the pandemic, there's no control group. We don't have the Pennsylvania equivalent where there was no virus. So it's going to be very, very hard to sort that out. And actually, that's the problem that's been confronting macroeconomists for hundreds of years.
Could you look, say, at different states? One state had very significant lockdowns and others did not. One state has certain mandates and others did not.
That you can study, and I'm sure there are quite a few studies along those lines. My understanding is that the lockdowns and things like that have some effect on the virus, but maybe not a huge enough effect to really allow you to precisely nail down what would happen if there was no virus.
All right. Now, can I ask you, David Card, just some questions, some broader labor market questions that are arising today? We're seeing strikes at Nabisco, at John Deere, nurses, Hollywood crews. Is there a broader labor disaffection you're seeing?
It's interesting. I don't know if you might not know this, but my undergraduate thesis was on strikes. And I wrote
in the
1980s, I wrote a couple of papers on strikes. So strikes used to be much more prevalent, and they were often exactly the same kind of scenarios we have today. So company appears to be doing well, but the workers feel like they're not getting a fair share of the return. So that is interesting that that's come back. There haven't been strikes for such a long time because we've been really, in many ways, in the last 20 years, we've had pretty tough times for workers. You know, first we had the Great Recession and then a really slow recovery from the Great Recession.
Mm-hmm.
It's also the case, I'm sure everyone, all your listeners are aware, that wages of workers on average have not really kept up with productivity or with the share of income going to profits.
So more of those rewards going to management, going to shareholders than workers?
Yes. There's been a remarkable change in the share of income going to wages and salaries in the United States in the last 15 years.
Now, there are workers who are unhappy about their situation. Is there any evidence that workers have more leverage these days than in past years?
A very simple measure of leverage is the number of vacancies relative to the number of unemployed workers.
Yeah.
That's a measure that economists call a measure of tightness in the labor market, and that's off the charts right now. So that means that, relative to the number of people looking, the number of openings is quite high. And what that means is that many, many workers are in a situation where they can potentially find a job at a little bit better firm. One of the things that I've worked on a lot in the last 10 years in my career is the idea of job ladders in the job market, that there's different firms paying different levels of wages and people are trying over the course of their career to get to a higher paying firm. And so a lot of these workers who've come from unemployment have to start at the bottom of the ladder in a relatively low paying job. But in a time like this, there's a lot of opportunities for you to possibly get to a unionized job or maybe a job with a large employer that has a more generous national policy.
Americans are quitting their jobs in larger numbers than we've ever seen, at least in the month of August. What does that tell you?
Well, I think it tells you that the labor market is quite good for workers and the opportunities are out there. You can see an increase in quits, but no reduction in total fraction of people working. So that means that these people are quitting and going to other jobs. They're not going to unemployment. And that is exactly what you'd expect in a strong labor market. That's what we really hope for.
I also want to ask you about something that's just part of the national conversation, is lost factory jobs in America. I mean, it's often said that outsourcing, sending jobs to other countries, quote, took their jobs, or that technology and robots took their jobs. As a labor economist, how do you visit this question?
This is a debate that's been going on since the Industrial Revolution, to tell you the truth, since the 1700s. So it's always been going on. You can see very clearly, for instance, in the United States, we had in 1900, we had a huge fraction of people working in farming. And today we only have just a tiny percent of people working in farming. And there's a huge increase in output of farming, but nobody working there anymore. I worked in a few factories in my youth.
Yeah.
I worked in a steel factory. And those jobs are tough jobs. It's true that they provided a decent living for less educated workers in the 1970s and 80s, but they were tough jobs, kind of like coal mining.
Yeah.
You know, those are really tough jobs, terrible on your health. So I wouldn't say that we should get too sentimental about them. We would hope, I guess what we're hoping is they're going to be replaced ultimately by jobs that are more rewarding and more valuable in the modern economy.
And safer, perhaps, healthier.
Yeah, sure. Definitely safer and healthier. Yeah.
David Card, professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley, and one of three recipients of the Nobel Prize in Economics this year. Congratulations on your work and the attention it's getting. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much.